recorded.
Recording in progress.
Okay, we're going to call to order the Texas Emergency Services Retirement System Board of Trustees. It's August 14th, 2013 at 8:30 a.m. TR, can we have roll call, please? Or Jessica?
Lamar Rodriguez.
Here.
Jerry Rivera.
Here.
Edward Cannon.
Here.
Nathan Douglas.
Here.
Matt Glaze.
Here.
Brad Landy.
Here.
Rodney Wells.
Here.
Brian Smith.
Here.
And Stephen Wagner.
Can I entertain a motion to excuse those members that are absent?
So moved. Second.
All those in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Okay, next we're going to have the oath of office for the newest trustee, Brad Landy. And so, Kristen Christie is going to give that oath of office.
Yeah. All right. Where do we go?
Up front.
Good morning, Trustee Landy. My name is Kristen Garcia. I'm a notary public with the state of Texas. This morning, I will be administering your oath of office to serve as a member of the Texas Emergency Services Retirement System Board of Trustees. Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Brad Landy.
I, Brad Landy.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute the duties.
That I will faithfully execute the duties.
Of the office of.
Of the office of.
Texas Emergency Services Retirement System.
Texas Emergency Services Retirement System.
Board of Trustees.
Board of Trustees.
Of the state of Texas.
Of the state of Texas.
And I will do my best.
And I will do my best.
Of my ability.
Of my ability.
To serve. Protect and defend.
To serve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution and laws.
The Constitution and laws.
Of the United States.
Of the United States.
And of this state, so help me God.
And of this state, so help me God.
Now, if you like to please have your seat. And I just need your signature. Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Brad, now you have all the rights and privileges and a full board member. For what it's worth. Okay, next item on the agenda is invitation for public comment. Jessica, do you have anybody that'd like to speak?
Yeah.
Okay. Next item on the agenda is number 5. It's approval of the minutes for the meeting held May the 5th, 2023. Are there any corrections, amendments, additions that we should submit? If not, can I make a motion to approve?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes as presented.
Second. Motion by Jerry and a second by Matt. All those in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Next item is the investment report on the investment performance. John's online, right? John, you ready?
Yes, sir, I'm ready.
Okay, the floor is yours.
Okay, great. I think you guys are ahead of schedule. So I was going to try and give you kind of the high points. And again, I apologize that I couldn't be there with the meeting swapping over to Monday. I was just not able to get there in person. So thank you all very much for letting me join you by Zoom this morning. So if I could, let me take you forward in this document to page 3. So the first one with the charts on it there. So I guess it would be PDF page 4 there. Perfect. So if we look at the top right, you know, so what we saw in the second quarter of 2023 was really some very strong continued performance out of stock markets. What's interesting, though, is, you know, April and May were kind of middling in terms of results. We really got a big boost towards the end of the quarter in June. That really made the quarter for domestic markets as well as for international markets. You know, I think one of the big things that we've seen kind of throughout 2023 is kind of relatively resilient growth in the United States, which has been supportive of stock prices. quarter, you saw a bit of normalization in the bond market. That really led to the negative returns that we saw for the bond market there in green, with the U.S. aggregate down 80 basis points, governments and TIPS kind of leading the way down. But what we did continue to see was outperformance in credit. So we'll see here corporate investment grade down only 30 basis points, and as we'll see a little bit later in the report, high yield bonds were actually positive for the quarter. So really a good environment for kind of higher risk securities within the bond market. You know, amazingly now, when you look at this 1 year performance, and obviously we're kind of closing in on the end of the Tusker's fiscal year, it's amazing to think back now that we're looking at almost a 20% annualized return from June to June. You know, if you think back to June 30 of last year, we were kind of knee deep in the midst of some of the confusion around inflation, around where the Fed was going to go in terms of its inflation actions. And so to now kind of see this extremely good result over the last year is pretty remarkable, especially when you look at, I think, the EPA return. So the EPA has really developed international markets. You see that return up very substantially, almost 19%, essentially in line with the S&P 500. And when you think about kind of the questions that we've seen over the last year about rising energy prices sparking recession in Europe, obviously the war in Ukraine, you know, there have been a lot of dominoes that seemingly are falling to the negative, but in the midst of this, we've seen the EPA produce a very strong return of almost 20%. And all this to say, you know, it's very cautionary for boards to try to get too macroeconomic in their thinking. You know, we always want to be aware of what's going on in the world, you know, but our goal is to kind of stay married to our long-term investment policy statement, which really kind of helps us weather these storms of whether it's euphoria or kind of complete grief when it comes to markets. If you look at the next page, page four, I was just going to point out, you know, we've actually seen growth continue to dominate performance. This is really the story Q1 and Q2. And as we'll see, a lot of this is tied to, you know, one, some of the euphoria over the use of artificial intelligence. Also, I think responsible is, you know, after we had kind of that banking crisis erupt in the U.S., which didn't turn into quite the banking crisis it was forecast to be, you did see the Federal Reserve, you saw the government come in, support markets with liquidity. And anytime we kind of see that combined with the drop in interest rates, that's tended to be very good for growth-related companies. And kind of to that point, if you move forward two more pages with me to PDF page number seven there, perfect. If you look at the top left, you'll really see, you know, this year, I guess the main term dominating market discussions is quote unquote the Magnificent Seven, which is essentially kind of these top seven holdings in the U.S. market. And you look at some of these names, some of the returns, and they were really kind of the most battered and beaten down companies last year. Whether you think of NVIDIA, you think of Meta, these stocks are up tremendously. You see NVIDIA up over 180% last year. Those numbers have actually only improved into the third quarter. And they're improved kind of to some nosebleed levels in terms of valuation. So NVIDIA at this point is priced at around 220 times earnings, which, you know, hard to believe that's going to be very sustainable. And so I think, you know, certainly though, in an environment like this, what gets very hard is for active managers to outperform. Because as you see these companies, they're getting more and more and more expensive. They're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And in order to kind of continue to grow, they've got to come up with some very wild growth rates to justify valuations. Apple's another great example of this. You see here, Apple's about a 7% weight in the Russell 1000 index. If we looked at the Russell 1000 growth, Apple's about a 13% weight. So again, if you're a manager like Fred Alger, and let's say you're very bullish on Apple, you've got 10%, well, you've now opened yourself up to potential underperformance if Apple keeps rallying because you just don't own as much. And one of the reasons that we're seeing managers kind of gravitate away from some of these mega cap stocks is valuation. When you look at Apple today, Apple's valued at over $3 trillion in market cap. To put that in context, Apple is now larger than the entirety of the Russell 2000 index. So that's the entirety of the U.S. small cap market. So again, periodically we'll see kind of these valuation distortions happen. Doesn't mean there's any big move we need to take, because again, we've kind of put these decisions in the hands of our active managers to kind of manage those valuations. managed risks in their portfolio. Vicar, let me take you forward, I think, a couple of pages. This is going to be PDF page 8, please. Perfect. So just for the quarter, just quickly on international, you know, I would say relatively benign environment for international. The biggest difference this quarter was that we did see a little bit of dollar strengthening. Again, I think that was tied to interest rates kind of sorting themselves out a bit during the quarter. We had kind of persistently seen rates kind of flattening out, leveling down over the last, call it Q4, Q1. And as they started to creep back up a little bit, that ended up leading to a little dollar strength. In emerging markets, though, I would say the biggest story has been China. You've seen China eliminate its zero COVID policy. There's a lot of belief coming into the year that that was going to lead to some really rampant growth in the country. And to this point, we really haven't seen that. There's been some questions, and there's headlines even in the journal today about some of the property markets, how much pressure is that going to put on the economy? While it's very hard to quantify exactly those impacts, I would say that China remains in what I would call a very stimulative position. They were one of the first to stop raising interest rates. Now they're moving towards lowering rates. But what we've really seen at this point is kind of the top end of the Chinese consumer has really benefited and shown some growth, while the baseline Chinese consumer has been a little bit slower. That's dragged down some of the performance in that country. And obviously with China, that's the biggest component of the emerging market index, that has a negative overall impact on emerging markets. From there, last page I wanted to touch on was fixed income on page number 9, which is PDF page 10. One more now, please. Thank you. So again, here, when we look at the fixed income market, again, investment grade was kind of facing a rising interest rate environment throughout the quarter. We saw that show up with negative returns in governments. Again, we've had this talk before, but when you look at that U.S. high yield bond index in the top right, it was up 1.7% for the quarter. High yield has a couple attributes that offer it some stability in periods of rising interest rates. One is shorter maturities, and two is higher coupons, meaning in order to loan into companies that are a little bit suspect in terms of their ability to repay their debts, they've got to shorten the time of a loan, and they've got to offer you more interest. And both of those factors work to make high yield a much less interest rate sensitive investment during a period like this. So that's really what we saw show up during this most recent quarter. I'm going to keep an eye on my time here. Let's move down to page number 13 on the PDF there. Perfect, asset allocation. And what you see is, up one more, please. Thank you. So when we look at this page, what you see is that we remain in line really with all of our long-term allowable investments. You do see multi-asset investments are at kind of the zero end of their range. Again, we're moved below target. That's a result of removing the BlackRock investment from the portfolio. We've got that investment held in cash at this point, and we'll kind of continue to evaluate kind of where that multi-asset target goes in the remainder of 2023. But for now, I would say there's no real pending need to actively rebalance the portfolio. I think we're still in good shape in terms of benefit payments, but if that were to kind of come up as we move towards the end of the year, we've got an immediate cash balance that we can tap into, and then we can also use that as an opportunity to rebalance some of our equity investments should we need to. But again, everything is in line with our long-term policy allocations and allowable ranges as of June 30. From there, let me take you forward to page number 16. One more down, I'm sorry. And so when we look at the fiscal year to date, what you see down at the bottom is we started this fiscal year at $120.9 million. We've seen net outflows from the plan of around $3.5 million, direct management fees of just under $400,000, and then return on or appreciation in income, totally up right around, $7.7 million. We do have a number of mutual funds in the plan, and as I would remind the board, those fees are priced into the daily net asset value of those funds. So when you look at, let's say, a Clarkston Partners or a Jackson Square, their fees are always priced into this appreciation, depreciation column. So we ended the month of June at $124.7 million. So good overall moments there. And so if we move forward one more page, let's look at percentage returns for the plan. So you see for the quarter, we're up around 2.6%, which was essentially in line with our policy index. Fiscal year to date, we're around 6.14%. I did get the July flash, and we are actually around 7.9% through July 30th, or 31st, excuse me, as we approach the end of the fiscal year. So kind of closing in on a relatively good fiscal year. August has been a little bit more volatile in markets, but overall in pretty good shape. You know, I think one thing I wanted to touch on, you know, when we look at domestic equity, it was actually a pretty good quarter for us. This has been an area, as you see over the fiscal year to date, it's been a little bit trickier. Interestingly, you know, you look at some of our large cap managers, Boston Partners, who's really been our kind of most consistent outperformer over the last few years, has struggled a little bit this year. I think a lot of that's just due to being overweight energy in an environment where crude oil's come down. Alder has actually started to perform pretty well now. You see fiscal year to date, they lagged just a little bit. We funded them really at the beginning of our last fiscal year. But importantly, what we saw this quarter was some of the individual decisions that they made, overweighting companies like Amazon, like NVIDIA, while underweighting Apple, have not kind of inhibited their ability to perform. So very encouraging, I would say, for Alder. They continue to, I would say, face the probably the toughest benchmark to beat across the domestic equity landscape. But I think what we're starting to see now is them stringing together some good, solid performance. And a little bit the same is true with Clarkston. If you recall, last quarter they lagged just a little bit. It was a little bit tougher environment for some of their investment management holdings as well as some of their financials that got caught up in some of the regional banking issues. But those have actually bounced back pretty nicely. The one manager who kind of underperformed more significantly is Jackson Square. This is a manager that we do have on watch, and we're going to keep them on watch as we move forward. You know, when you look at this quarter, it was actually some of the same stocks that drove them in Q1 pulled them back this quarter. Some of those disruptor stocks that we've talked about before, like a Wix.com, a Peloton, you know, really kind of undermined some of their performance really in the month of June. But what I would also point out, when you look at kind of the small to mid-growth space, this quarter really saw kind of a little bit of a shift in terms of market dynamics where you actually had negative earners, companies with a lot of debt on their balance sheet, I would say generally what we would call lower quality companies, really leading the market. Not necessarily an area that Jackson Square is going to focus on as they kind of focus on growth and focus on a return on invested capital. So not surprising to maybe see them lag a little bit, but obviously for a manager on watch, we want to see them stringing together some good performance and not giving up some ground like we did this quarter. So we're going to keep them on watch as we move into the second half of this year. On page 18, when we look at international, you know, what we see here is the managers actually all work really well to generate some outperformance. You're kind of seeing this, you know, really over this kind of three-year and end cycle. A couple of things that we've done over the last 3 years was the biggest thing was adding Oakmark. You see over that three-year window, they're up 14%, basically doubling the return of the all-country world. You know, I think the biggest thing there was we proved to be a little bit early in adding the value piece to our international. But now that we've really seen value start stringing some wins together on a quarterly basis, they've generated some nice outperformance. And then blending them with Invesco this year has been really good. You know, Invesco is a very thematic growth investor. One of their biggest themes is things like the Internet of Things, which is very much semiconductor-focused. And in an environment like we've seen in 2023, not in any way surprising to see them outperforming that NEPA index very significantly. And then the last piece I wanted to touch on was the international. It's Allspring Emerging Markets. So this is a manager, again, that we've had on watch. But they've done really exactly what we want to see a manager on watch do, which is actually start slowly but surely stringing together some outperformance. So in 2021, they lagged their benchmark return by about 9%. Last year, they outperformed slightly. And then as you see year to date this year, they're outperforming. But when I look back at emerging index. But they have, I think, done a better job of managing their allocation in the country, as well as managing, you know, kind of their individual stock selection risk there. And so AllSpring is actually a manager that I'm going to recommend that the board takes off watch, because again, I think that we've seen stability through their ownership transition, team stability, and now we're seeing that performance stability come through as well. On fixed income, I would say that, you know, duration and interest rate sensitivity really dictated this quarter. You see total fixed income actually slightly outperform the policy index. We're outperforming as well on the fiscal year to date and year to date basis. Really, the one manager that stood out this quarter was Garcia Hamilton. If you recall, they were a manager that kind of had viewed interest rates as having peaked in the U.S. in about October of last year. That allowed them to become a little bit more interest rate sensitive, anticipating rates would slide lower. That obviously played out in the first quarter of this year, but obviously worked against them a bit for the quarter. So they did give up a little bit of ground, but you see year to date, still handily outperforming and essentially matching the return of Richmond. Richmond tends to be a little bit more credit focused, don't really take an interest rate position in their portfolio, very much kind of a singles and doubles type manager. But as we see over time, you know, we continue to get paid for paying fees within our actively managed fixed income. And then the last manager I was going to touch on in fixed is PIMCO Diversified. They're our multi-sector bond manager, giving us exposure to things like high yield bonds, emerging market debt. As I talked about, it's a very good quarter for risk assets within fixed income, and we saw them outperform pretty nicely during the most recent quarter. So again, high yield was really the big driver within PIMCO's portfolio. They continue to be very skeptical in terms of taking too much credit risk. They've actually tried to consolidate a lot of that exposure in financial services. That was a little bit more volatile in Q1 of this year, but those credits recovered nicely going into Q2. On the next page, just kind of looking at, I guess, what we call our alternatives, you know, looking at Morgan Stanley and IFM, you know, both managers generated decent returns this quarter. Morgan Stanley obviously is facing an environment where returns in the core real estate space are coming down. You see that just over the last year, the NCREIF open-ended Odyssey Index is down about 10%. You know, this is really driven by appraisal pressure on the heels of interest rate pressure. You know, if you think about, you know, essentially all asset classes, they're competing for capital. And as interest rates rise, that can draw attention from fixed income, it can draw attention from equities. And so you have to see, interest rates and cap rates, as we call them in the real estate space, adjust for that. Obviously, when you think about capitalization rates in real estate, that's your rent divided by the price of a building. And your rents aren't going to fluctuate too much. There's been some areas of the market that are a little bit quicker to be able to adjust. But really, the main adjustment factor is price. And so this year, what we've really seen is a pretty heavy pressure on the office market. Not surprising. Office properties are down around 20% this year. And so what you really needed to see was a manager do pretty much what Morgan Stanley has done over the last 5 years, which is, you know, kind of diversify their retail, moving away from malls towards some more grocery anchored shopping, adding things like self-storage, manufactured housing, student housing, life sciences. Again, no one's going to kind of abandon their lease to work from home in a laboratory setting. So some of these incremental things that Morgan Stanley's done have enabled them to be really well positioned to kind of weather this pullback. I'd say the other big thing that they have done was really reduce the leverage risk in their portfolio, so bringing down some of the debt on their portfolio, as when you have a higher level of debt, that can then ultimately kind of exacerbate some of the pressure that you see when prices come down. And then lastly, IFM, you know, we compare this to a 50-50 stock bond benchmark. It held in pretty nicely this quarter, I would say. Probably a little bit better than I would have expected, you know, given the fact that stock bond benchmark was really driven by this rapid outperformance in technology stocks. That's certainly been the case year to date. But, you know, this is a manager that has assets spread across the infrastructure space, toll roads, utilities, airports, shipping terminals. I would say airports kind of continue to be one of the biggest drivers of return here. Kind of a lot of the healing that we're seeing in air travel is kind of accruing to a little bit better income production within the IFM portfolio. So very kind of incremental. know, singles and doubles type of returns from them. You know, as you see, our timing of this was pretty good relative to a global balance benchmark. You know, they're up about 10% since we hired them back in 2021. But again, anytime we see a sharp, equity bull market, they're always going to lag that just a little bit. So that's why we always want to kind of keep maybe a little bit more of our focus on the longer term with a more private investment-oriented manager like IFM. So again, as we look through the portfolio this quarter, no manager issues to notify the board over. We did eliminate BlackRock during the quarter, so we were essentially kind of one subtraction from the manager lineup. The recommendations on the watch list would be to maintain Jackson Square's position and then to remove Allspring Emerging Markets from their position on the watch list. So let me stop there, see if there's any questions from the audience.
Any questions? No. No questions, John.
I think the only other items on my agenda were IPS, asset allocation. I don't have any proposed changes for the board, so I think really the only thing would be if there's a motion around kind of a watch list.
Okay. All right. Is there any other questions from the trustees? If not, I'm going to need several motions. On item 5A, we need a motion to accept the investment consultant's report.
So moved.
Motion by Jerry, second by Matt. All those in favor, signify by aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign, motion carries. And on item 5B, we need a motion to accept the investment consultant's recommendation to maintain Jackson Square on the watch list and to have the Tether staff move forward with a peer review of Jackson Square.
So moved. Second.
Motion by Matt, second by Jerry. All those in favor, signify by aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign, motion carries. And item 5C, need a motion to accept the investment consultant's recommendation to remove Allspring Emerging Markets off the watch list.
So moved.
Motion by Jerry, second by Matt. All those in favor, signify by aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign, motion carries. Okay, we'll move on to item 6. Thank you, John.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Right, okay. We'll move on to item 6, which is the financial budget report.
Good morning, everyone. My name is AJ Weber. I'm the pension administration partner at Lauterbach and Amen, so happy to be here with you guys in person this morning. I don't have the page numbers of the board packet, but I'm going to start with the non-appropriated budget and expenditures for 2023. So not much different from what you saw. Good. All right. Now I'll show you what you guys saw at the last board meeting, except we have updated expenditures through June 31st, that second column from the left-hand side. As a point of contention, the expenditures are cash basis, so when we book the expense, we see it hit the bank account, we see a check get paid, we book it as an expense. When we start filling out your audit come August 31st, it'll be your fiduciary funds, which is required to be full accrual. So if you look at the investment expense line item, we still expect investment expenses to lag just a little bit, so those will be closer to budget, because those expenses, although will be paid in August or September, will be for the current fiscal year. Any questions on the non-appropriated fund budget?
You said June, do you mean July 31st?
Your August 31st year end, so if the expense hits in September or
No, the document I'm looking at is through July 31st?
Correct.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, did I say June?
Yeah. Excuse me, I just want to make sure.
Yeah, so through July. Through July.
August, September, 2 months left.
1 month left. Just August.
So with the investment expense, do you see it staying pretty much in line?
Yeah, I think you'll still be within budget, but you basically have a quarter's worth of expenses yet to expend.
Okay.
The next up, we have the Fund 1 or appropriated fund budgets for the fiscal year. Again, the middle column is going to show you actual expenses through July 31st. Everything pretty well within budget. Again, you had your CFO leave in October, so some of that budget shifted from personnel over to the consulting you saw in the non-appropriated. Any questions on the Fund 1? Okay, speaking a little bit about 2024, the next couple of pages give you a projection for not only a revenue budget, but the expense budget for 2024 for appropriated and non-appropriated.
Yep, scroll down a page for me.
Which one is it?
Go to the budget adoption, FY24. C. Thank you. So the big number to point out here is the second from the top number. That's your GR dedicated fund. So in September, you'll receive $1,292,763. This represents about a 2% increase from what you received last fiscal year. You get this every year in September. And then scroll down to the Excel budget, page 3. Thank you. So again, show you what you had budgeted in the left-hand column for 2023. You are through July 31st, 23 expenditures in the middle column, and we're proposing for your 24 budget. So everything that's starred has indicated that this is really based on a contractual renewal of some of those agreements. So your actuary, your outside contract counsel, your financial audit, our CFO services, our accounting services, all waiting to confirm those contracts, which I know are on the agendas today.
Going back to what the state contributed, is that in line with the one-third of our department contributions?
It is, and you'll see that in just a second.
Okay.
You said, though, that was an increase, but wasn't it decreased that last year? Isn't that fund the one that was decreased?
You got 1.262,763 last year. It's about a $30,000 increase from fiscal year 23. I'm not sure about fiscal year 22. Okay.
I thought there was something from the state where that was reduced across the board, and that's why I was disappointed.
I'll get back to you on that question. I'll look at 22 for you.
Okay.
Yeah, didn't that have something to do with COVID or something?
I thought so.
So again, for the 24 budget, really based off of mostly the 23 numbers, especially for the investment expenses that we do expect to hit pretty close to budget once we put your financials to full accrual with the audit prep. Any questions on that piece? Okay, the last thing we wanted to provide is give you a little bit better projection of your cash flow for the next fiscal year. Yep, item D for me. Thank you. Can you pull that up just a little bit? Thank you. So what we're trying to do here is anticipate times where the pension fund is going to need to draw down funds from investments. This will give ANCO a little bit better time and a heads up to when they're going to need to liquidate funds. They're not doing a fire sale to make sure we're meeting pension investments or pension beneficiaries. So if you look at the orange bars, the 1.292 is the statutory receipt from the fund from the state, so your GR fund. And if you look at the other two large orange bars, 1.897 and 1.814, those are the member contributions we're expecting to receive throughout the course of the next fiscal year. The blue items on the bottom represent expenses. So your beneficiary expenses, investment expenses, you can see the blue items, the blue bars drop down quarterly. So all the expenses we're anticipating. And the yellow bars above the line is our proposed drawdown from your investments. So we took your current, as of last week, we took your current cash in treasury as our starting point. So this is our anticipated schedule of drawdowns to keep you guys at 1 month of expenses in cash. Usually anywhere from pretty close to lean, you can get a little closer if you want to keep money in the ANCO account invested. But a good rule of thumb is anywhere between 1 and 3 months of anticipated expenses and cash. So we will update this as we get closer to a good cash number at the end of the fiscal year. We'll share this with ANCO to make sure that they're aware.
Any other questions for AJ? Okay. Well, this is a report only, so there's no action required by the board. Thank you. Thank you, AJ.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is the cybersecurity briefing by CBiz, Kim Bradley, and George Peterson.
Good again, everyone. Kim Bradley with Sea Biz Risk and Advisory Services. George didn't join today, but he'll be here probably on the next one. Just as a recap of the services we're providing to TESRs, it's anything and everything cybersecurity related that TESRs needs from us, but primarily helping going through remediating the cybersecurity framework assessment report findings and prioritize those, and they're going through those to help remediate those findings. A big part of that is helping develop policies and procedures related to cybersecurity and conducting cybersecurity awareness training, and then addressing any TESRs cybersecurity questions or concerns, or providing guidance as requested as things come up, as they often do. Next slide. The what we've completed in the last quarter or so, since we're still in August here, we conducted the annual cybersecurity awareness training. We did an on-site training for all the TESR staff that we could get in the training on August 3rd, and the training topics included definitions of some key terms, cyber confidentiality, integrity, and availability, and information security, defining cybersecurity risk, what goes into that, some key tips on password security, how to build strong passwords and keep those safe, and going through TESR's clean desktop policy. And then we had a nice little module on social engineering related to risk from email phishing and phone, it's technically called vishing, but phone phishing, and how to spot that and not provide sensitive information that way. And then went through some items on telework and telecommuting, and then did a brief module on artificial intelligence and defining that, and kind of it's early in the process. There aren't a lot of guidelines on that, but just some tips on how to be very cautious in using artificial intelligence. Any questions on what we covered in that? I thought the training went really well. We had very good interaction with the TESR staff and back and forth, and felt like it was well received, and they understood the concepts really well, so that was very successful. The next slide, kind of the in progress, is we're finalizing the following policies: the telework, data classification and data management, and electronic communication policy. So those will be finalized soon. We've drafted an acceptable use policy, not accessible. On the slide, acceptable use policy. So that one's drafted, and then we're doing a final review, and then that one will go up into the finalizing category, and that one will be done pretty soon. And we started drafting a business continuity policy. That one's in the early stages. We need to do a lot of coordination with TESRs on that one, but that's the next policy that we are currently developing. And then the next steps on the next slide, we're going to finalize the four policies at the top of the previous slide, continue to be providing assistance to remediate the cybersecurity framework report findings. And then the next on the list, in the order on the slide there, after we get the business continuity policy developed, then we're going to go into the business continuity plan. So that's the actual plan with the steps that would be followed if you needed to initiate that if you're unable to continue your business processes due to not being able to access the building. How do you have an alternate plan for that? Things like that that we kind of have encountered in recent years with COVID and other situations. So that will be the actual plan. That's a lot more detailed and involved than the policy itself. It will just be guided by the policy that we're developing right now. And then next will be incident response and reporting policy, and then the incident response plan, and then disaster recovery policy followed by the plan, password policy, and configuration management policy. So there are a lot of policies that we're helping develop. And then just the always other cyber assistance as needed as things come up from the state and other things there. So I think that's it. Any questions?
A question, yeah. There's a lot of policies.
Yes.
I'm assuming you prioritized them, Mr. Wishel, need to get done first so we can continue to move forward, ensure we're covered from all aspects of cybersecurity and so forth.
Absolutely. They're kind of in the order that are listed on that slide, but I think password policy probably will pop up there because that one won't be as tedious as like the business continuity plan. Those plans are going to be the longer ones, so we're probably going to move policies up in that to get them done as we're working on the plan and work on them concurrently.
Well, is there anything right now that's an immediate thing that has to get done that is maybe a risk to us?
I think that getting that acceptable use policy, that was a big one, I think, to be able to have guidance for staff to guidelines for things you can do and can't do. And I also think that training that was conducted, we had a lot of the phishing is just such a big risk, and it also covered internet safety. So if you're on the internet, you know, how to be careful clicking on things. So I think the users, the people, and this isn't a negative to people because we all are in that category, are the biggest risk. And so that's why the training was a focus, the acceptable use policy is a focus, and the telework policy and some of those other ones. That's what we discussed with Jessica, and the order and the priority on those and how to best get as many done as we can while we're addressing the risk. And that's why business continuity was up there pretty high, so you have a plan in place for that as well. I think that's a high priority topic for TESR. So the answer is yes.
Got one question.
Yes.
Excuse my naivete, I guess. But have you had phishing with Barracuda? Have they come out with when it came? We get stuff across it. We assume that that's a secure. You understand where I'm going with this?
So tools like Barracuda do have protections in place that identify signatures of a lot of phishing emails,
right. But
there are some that get through, and no tool can prevent 100%. And so this training is to help the user just be aware that that tool is not perfect, but it is robust. It does a good job, but the bad guys are always finding ways to get around.
Right.
They know what's being blocked, and then working to get around that. So, but it is a good tool. If you didn't have anything, it would be really bad. Just public email addresses and such.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Kim? If not, this is a report only from Kim, and no action required by the board. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item, the agenda item number 8, is human resources. We have new hire introductions and human resource assessment, and we've got Jessica and Susan Johnson that are going to make the presentation.
Yes. So for new hire introductions, I would like to ask Michael, who is our new executive assistant, to stand up and make his own introduction.
Hi, board. My name is Michael Villanueva. Glad to be here. I will be the executive assistant for TESR. I have about 17 years experience with a state agency, with only one that I've been with for 17 years, which was the comptroller's office. I did HR there for about 10 years in there, but when I first got there, I did something totally different. I did document management, where it's pretty much formatting reports, putting data together, sending out mailings and everything else. But I also have 7 years with the school district as well in San Marcos. Being one of the first male executive assistants or a finance clerk or secretary there, I was the first one that they had right out of high school. They kept me on a work study program with them, so I stayed on and did 17 years. So altogether, I got about 24 years. And I always tell people I got almost 6 years left till retirement. So because I count those years together. So I'm happy to be here. But yeah, I do have my experience with finance, human resources, document management, board management, because I've served on the board before in my hometown for 5 years, being a treasurer down there. So I do have a lot of experience bringing on to this agency as well. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. Welcome, Michael.
Michael, for our agency, he's taken off running, helped with the board, policies bringing in, and he's helped me tremendously with CAPS. I contacted the CAPS help desk, And Michael works there, and Michael can get you through. So he's very well tuned with the comptroller's office. We're fortunate and very glad to have him on board. Up next is Kristen Gracie.
Good morning, Chairman. Good morning, trustees. My name is Kristen Garcia, and I'm a certified contract manager. I always forget that, CTZM. I have a little over 20 years of experience with the state of Texas, working at various agencies. I do have an associate's degree as a legal assistant. So many of my roles have been in either an executive or legal type of administrative role. I've really enjoyed working in the state. It's been a very, very educational and awesome experience. So I do want to take this opportunity to thank the TESR team and also the board for a very warm welcome and having patience with learning the new processes and everything. So thank you again. I greatly appreciate it. I'm glad I'm part of the team.
It's been a pleasure having her, and we get to contract administration later. You can see her legal fees and her attention to detail definitely show.
Anything else?
Okay. Susan? So good morning again, board. And once again, I come back last month. I think I just shared with you a copy of the assessment for this month. The assessment has been completed, and I'm giving you an update on what I've found. So the first thing I want to talk about is why you need to do an assessment and why it's important. There are really three goals of an HR assessment. Is for you to summarize your strengths and weaknesses. And I always want to call weaknesses undeveloped strengths, because if it's a weakness, you can make it into a strength if you know that it's a weakness. So that's part of what we've learned in this process. It's an opportunity to look at the policies and to evaluate them and to make sure that they're aligned with your goals and your mission of the agency. And then it helps you to identify problems and inefficiencies. So I came up with a little scorecard, because that's what you asked me for. And then I'll go into more details. There were 115 items in this assessment. I was able to answer 27 yes, because of course you want to be able to answer yes to all of them. But out of the 115, based on the information I had, I was able to say yes to 27, and you can see those 27 when you go in there. There were 67 questions that were no. There were seven that were NA, so you're thinking, well, what's an NA? One thing about the organizational structure of the agency is there are no supervisors, there's no managers, and there's no directors. It's just a flat organization with everybody reporting to the executive director. And what you see in that process is that you have no succession planning. So say this past month, without an executive director, there was nothing in place to make things continue to move, because some of your key staff you have now contracted out, which is your chief financial officer, because that person would be the next key person in the agency. And as you know, a contractor cannot have access to the comptroller system. They don't allow contractors to have. So whenever the contractor needs something, they have to call the agency, and then the agency has to call the contractor. But we'll get more into that. There were 21 questions I could not answer, because the person who was in the HR role is no longer there, and because Tiffany was not, executive director was not available, I couldn't answer those questions. And those were like, you know, how do you come up with the questions, some things about the selection process when you're doing the interviewing for recruitment. But I came up with seven red flags, and I think this is important, because in state government, it doesn't matter if you're an agency of 10 or you're a health and human service or TxDOT or parks and wildlife where you have 30, 50,000 employees, you are all held to the same compliance requirement. So, your agency's strategic plan. You have a plan, but it's piecemeal. What are your plans for the next 4 years? Not just your marketing plan. That should be visible on your website, and your board should know it, and the public should know it. Your workforce plan. You don't have a plan. Every state agency has to have a workforce plan. That means, how are you going to recruit staff to fill positions? What are your plans for employment for your agency? The next one, and I think Seabrook has talked about this, you're required to have a continuity of operation planning, and it's called a COOP. And so that's required of every state agency, and it's bigger than cybersecurity, but it's something that you have to have in place, and currently that's not in place. Staff training, I think that's a great area that needs to be developed. CAPS, every employee needs to be trained on CAPS, either on the financial side, if they're dealing the financial side, or just the employee side. Purchasing and procurement, we learned this past month, and this has been an ongoing practice of the agency, you have not been using the requisition process that's required by the Comptroller's Office. The agency, for years, have just been making purchases. This will be a big red flag when you're audited, and so that's something that you really need to take care of. And then every employee should understand the CAPS timekeeping. They should be using it, and then they should know how to be able to identify their benefits in CAPS. So we've kind of come up with a master training plan of what training that's needed, like for travel. Anybody who's doing travel needs to have the travel training. And there's someone assigned from the Comptroller's Office that can provide this training to staff, and they have it online or in person. The whole contract administration, one of the best hires that we made has been Kirsten because she's certified. You are not to do an agency to do any contracting unless the person who is managing that it has been certified. Also, all of that information is entered into CAPS. Currently, we are not using that process. In the CAPS process, there's a tree and there's an approval process. So it starts with, in how it should work, with the executive director, it goes to the chief financial officer. They can tell you, is it in the budget? We have money to do it. Then it goes to purchasing does the requisition, and then, but there are different levels of approval. Because you don't have adequate staff to do that, it really is putting you, and that was one of the things the state auditors wrote you up for last time, was for the process. Because once again, the contractor cannot approve anything in CAPS. So that's a critical deficiency that you have. So this last month, Jessica has had to try to become a CAPS user, an advanced user, to be able to make these things happen. So we went in, she went into CAPS, and what we saw, and Michael, thank goodness Michael was on board, he had CAPS experience, he had relationships with the CAPS people in the Comptroller's Office, and we were able to see things that could keep the agency moving this past month. There were a lot of outdated staff who were still listed in the tree, that's why you couldn't add more people on, because you hadn't removed the old people. So the good thing, we learned a lot of things to kind of tie it back to this. The next thing is the whole performance planning evaluation. Yes, you did the job descriptions for the additional funding for the appropriation to bring staff to the mid-level, and you got approval for that, and you need to move forward with that, but you don't have clear performance evaluation, all that you have and what I could see in the system, you have CAPS, and CAPS has a performance evaluation, but CAPS only records the core competencies for you, like teamwork. You work well as a team, you become just a basic thing. So you don't have clear, measurable, SMART goals for employees to know what do you need to do to get meets, exceeds merit. So there's not clear, measurable goals for staff. And I think what happens, because you're small and somebody leaves, you take on a new task, but you don't take on the changing the job. You can't do that without changing the job description, looking at the classification, and making sure the person is trained to do that job. The next one is the procurement contracts, and we're working on that. I think Jessica is scheduled to go and get her certification. There's a basic class that everyone has to take before they start the certification process. And I am recommending that anyone who touches contracts, be they on the pension side or on the administration operation, they need to take the basic class so that they understand the procurement process, the contracting, the purchasing, how it operates. And the next one is, there are a lot of policies online. From 2017, 2018, you don't have an employee handbook. That's the next project I'm working on. I already have an outline for it. But you need all of your policies in one document where employees acknowledge that they have received these policies, that they understand them, and that you talk to them about them. And in these policies are like your progressive discipline policies. How do you handle grievances and complaints? All of this is part of the human resource statutes. So I wanted to give you an idea of who all of our compliance requirements are coming from. It's not just one place. So CAPS, and when you hear us use that term, because one thing we do in state government, we have an acronym for everything. But CAPS is the Centralized Accounting and Payroll Personnel. So it has two sides. Payroll, that's how we get our checks. That's how the pension, the comptroller cuts everybody's check. But they also do travel and they do contract management. And you remember several years ago, there was a big stink in state government regarding contracts, where people were giving contracts to their friends and they weren't going through the procurement process. They were doing sole source contracts. So that's why the whole contract piece came into place with the comptroller, and they did legislative a bill to require that all state agencies use this system. So when the legislators ask for any contract information, they go straight to the comptroller. They don't come to the agency. So that's why it's key that all the information is kept in their repository. Okay? The State Auditor's Office, they are the keeper of the Texas Human Resource Management Statute. So anything that has to do with travel, with benefits, with performance evaluations, salary policy, we get from them. They are updating the statute now. It's online. You can see it. They will come out and audit you and use the same assessment that we just went over. They also provide job descriptions. So you don't have to sit up and make up job descriptions. They have a whole library of job descriptions, job classifications, and then they give you the salary schedule. And the schedule, the new schedule based on the budget, is already available. The Legislative Budget Board, who also do audits, we're responsible for them for providing the budget and our performance measures. And this, the next one is key to you, for you, is the Sunset Commission. You are up for review in 2028-29 review cycle. This is when the Sunset Commission will come and evaluate you as an agency and determine if you should continue as an agency or if you should be put under conservatorship or if you would be like one of those agencies if they just merge under the comptroller's office as another division. So it's critical that all these red flags that you take care of prior to the Sunset review, because that during that review, not only will they evaluate you, they'll be talking to your stakeholders and communities about your services and what you do. The next one is a big one, the continuity of operations program. It's more than just a report. It requires training from FEMA on emergency management as part of the COOP. It's cybersecurity. It's more than if something happens to the building, how would you operate? It's where your data is stored. How would you be able to function? It's exercises to practice for an emergency, but that plan, we should already have a plan. We should be working on a plan, and we should be taking part in those exercises that they do as part of that. And then, of course, ERS is our employment retirement system, and OAG, we ask them for advice, and especially with contracts, when we do amendments, we have to get their approval. It's outside of the scope. So on the next couple of pages, I'm not going to go over those, but those are the comments. But the survey looks at general administration. It looks at the leadership. It looks at recruitment and selection. It looks at employment training and development. You do not have a trainer on staff. That would be helpful if you had a person who could conduct some of the training, especially the mandatory training. We don't have an employee orientation program. We are currently using a checklist, performing appraisal, that's in the classification and compensation, employee benefits and leave, employee relations, you don't have in place, and then other policies, which are your sexual harassment, your complaints and grievance process. So, any questions for me? That was a lot.
Yeah. So I have a question, Susan. Yes. You know, you kind of threw a lot at us as far as the compliance, and in my mind, it sounds like we have to hire a gajillion people to be, so that's what I was going to ask, is there a plan on how we're going to tackle this and who's going to be responsible for these different compliance areas, and is it going to have an impact on staffing? Do we need to hire more people? You know?
So to answer your question, and I'm going to respond to this through my organizational development, you need more people. But you also need to look at the division of duties. Your key functions you have contracted out. The chief financial officer, your IT, and there's one other, your legal piece, three. In most agencies, those are staff positions. So when you contract out these services, you're still, it's not like they can do everything an in-house person would do. What we've done in this process is I've looked at everything that needs to be done, like all these tasks, and who can do them, and who needs to be trained to do them. Because for some of these things, you just can't say, I'll do it. You really do need to be trained. So yes, you do need more staff, but you need to look at your structure, this flat structure, and not having, and even on your organization, like Scott is listed as a director, but he doesn't supervise anybody. He doesn't have staff. He works with Tiara and he works with Brent, but he's not their supervisor. So the executive director has to write the evaluations for all 10 people. So you need to have a plan where you're developing supervisors, managers, directors, so that when you have an emergency, it's not all in one person's head and you can keep functioning.
Thank you.
I have a question. Does the state of Texas have a mandatory guideline as far as what a director consists of? How many people understaffed would be considered a director and so forth?
Yes.
Because, I mean, when you're looking at an organization like us, and we have, what, 10 staff people allocated to an organization?
Right.
That's not a lot of people to be setting up that kind of structure that you're talking about. It's not going to be flat. It shouldn't be flat. I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But there can't be that many levels.
But you can have team leads.
Okay.
You can have two sides of the house. Because what you really do have is two sides. You have an administration side, and then you have the pension side. Then you can have marketing. So you can have, you don't have to necessarily have a director. They have other titles. You could be a team lead where you can't hire and you can't fire. That's the only thing between a team lead and a manager and supervisor. A manager and supervisor can hire you and fire you. That's, of course, executive director. But a team lead has, you have all the responsibilities, but no authority. So there are titles that you can give people. Program administrator. When I started out in state government, I was a program specialist. I supervised one person, but there was someone else who reviewed that evaluation and signed off on it. And let me talk about the policies, and that's one of the things that has been on that wall in Tiffany's office. When you don't have written policies, when you have an emergency, you don't have anything to go to. You have notes. So you should have standard operating procedures for every division or unit within your agency. And you should have them in place, and everybody should know where they are and what's in them. And you cross-train people. That's how you develop employees. Right now, we don't have a plan in place to develop employees.
So let me have a follow-up question here. So looking at your chart, you put in here that the employee handbook is in progress. I know you mentioned it before. You're saying that their HR policy manual is outdated. But then you're saying our HR policies are current, and they're dated from 2017 to 2018.
They say guidelines.
The guidelines.
One says guideline, one says policy, but it's 2018, 2019, but they never were updated to include some of the new statutes that are part of the management statutes. That's what I'm saying. Take those, look at them, and see what's the difference, and is it consistent with what's in the human resource statutes? Put that in, because basically you should be pulling from the human resource statute.
So that would be your low-hanging fruit. That's the stuff you want to go ahead and update as soon as possible and get it to through an approval process.
Yes, and that keyword, approval process. Because you really shouldn't be just developing policies and not have an approval process. The good thing about it, Michael Fieldwood sitting over there, that's his background too. So we have the expertise in-house to do the employment piece, to keep moving on. Like I said, there's nothing on this list that you can't turn around, but I think you're going to have to look at staffing, those key responsibilities, because your three key functions are contracted out and what that means for the agency.
Any other questions for Susan? No? Okay. So thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Appreciate the report. So I'd like to go out of order on the agenda and go to item number 14. However, before we just to go into closed session. However, before we do that, does anybody need to take a break so we can recess for a couple minutes?
I'll want to.
Okay, we'll go ahead and it is 9:40, and we'll recess for 10 minutes, and we'll come back to the session at 9:50.